You are listening to Vueltas y Revueltas, the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 5. Today we are in Albacete.
He's King Kenny to a lot of fans. Well, he's the king of the welter tonight. But how is he known in the team? What kind of guy is Kenny Ellis on?
He's well read, a bit of a philosopher, and I guess if I had to sum him up, I think of him as being Parisian rather than French.
And on the day of the welter that everyone said was going to, well, there were going to be crosswinds, the flattest day of the welter, this place, it got its name from, well, the Arabic for flat, the lightest guy in the welter takes the red jersey.
Yeah, I mean, for sure he's a fan favorite, but I also think he's got a lot of friends in the peloton, so there'll be a lot of people happy about it.
Well, we open tonight with Kyle Ryanan, the man with the longest hair in professional cycling, probably, who rides for Trek Segafredo, and is a teammate of the new red jersey, the new overall leader at the Vuelta a España, Kenny Ellison. My name's Richard Moore, and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hola, Richard. Hola, Daniel.
Oh, he's been studying. He's been studying before we've
neither
been away.
Neither of us are with Daniel Freeb.
He's going to embarrass us. Hello, Rich, from Spain. Hello from Albacete. Missing you. Missing you a lot.
Well, missing you, missing the Vuelta. Easy now. I'm missing the Vuelta. It's very strange to come away from the race, but I am going back, and I'm already kind of looking forward to that.
Can you hear the wind, chaps? Can you hear the wind whipping through this taperia, this tapas bar?
The wind started blowing as soon as the stage finished.
4 hours too late.
Well, we sort of we were studying the wind speeds all day, and it looked as though they were going to be between about 15 kilometers an hour and 20 kilometers an hour, and I thought that might be enough. And certainly, you know, all the teams, as discussed last night, all the riders had the message that there was this turn at 31 kilometers to go, a left turn, and that was where it was going to all blow apart, as it always has done in Albacete, and it didn't happen. I mean, I saw quotes, I don't know if you chaps did, from Fernando Escartín, the former Kelme rider, who's now the sort of route master, the route designer of the Vuelta. He said that he had designed today's stage for maximum nastiness as far as crosswinds were concerned. But it didn't.
Well, there was nastiness.
Yeah.
There was nastiness, wasn't there? But not caused by the crosswinds. I mean, we heard Kyle Ryanan at the start there describe the new red jersey. We'll discuss Kenny Ellison and his unlikely ascent to the overall leadership, not least because of the interview he gave you this morning at the start, Daniel, where he explained how he had absolutely no ambition whatsoever to take the red jersey. So it's been fascinating in that context.
Extraordinary how we plant ideas in riders' heads, isn't it? You know, how I finally talked him round at the end of that interview, but we'll hear that later maybe.
Yeah, he still looked quite a reluctant wearer of the red jersey on the podium, but I'm sure that was explained by the circumstances. Lots to talk about. Can you give us a tale of the etapa, please, Lionel?
I can do, Rich. Yeah, well, it was another long straight road and another crash and a very costly one for the wearer of the red jersey, Rein Taramay, who, as you say, has lost the red jersey to Kenny Ellison because of that crash. Before all of that, there were the three amigos from the three Spanish wildcard teams up the road. We've seen Burgos, Caja Rural and Euskaltel in the breaks pretty much every day, and three of them were away again today. Pulayo Sanchez of Burgos, Oyer Lozcano of Caja Rural and Xavier Asparen of Euskaltel, who was in the break the other day as well. And they were allowed to go up the road, never really got out of hand as far as the peloton were concerned, and they got dropped.
Just a note on that, Lionel. Just a note. Sanchez was in the break on the very first day.
He was. He was.
The first man. First man to start the time trial.
Is there not a Sanchez in the break every day at the Vuelta?
Young Sanchez was the first man off in the time trial. So, you know, technically, he was in the breakaway that day.
Well, he was also the first man dropped from the break with 34 kilometres to go. The leader still had a couple of minutes at that point. Everyone was anticipating this change of direction and some crosswinds causing havoc with 31 kilometres to go, as you say, Daniel. But really, it wasn't windy enough even for sort of kite flying or, I don't know, a little child's windmill. It was fairly calm out there. Asparen was then dropped with 22-ish kilometres to go, and that left Lazcano out in front until around about 16 kilometres to go. And then, just as we saw yesterday, although a lot closer to the finish yesterday, there was a crash with 11.7 kilometres to go, right in the middle of the bunch, very close to the front. It was, unfortunately, the Danish champion Mads Wurt Schmidt who went down first and caused chaos around and behind him. And another man in red, Ryan Taramay, was down, and he was down for a long while, really, in the grand scheme of things. The red jersey was slipping away from him. He didn't have a great deal of support from his Intermarché teammates. In fact, it took about 5 or 6 kilometres until a couple of them dropped back and joined him. I think there were three in the front group and one...
Four.
Three in the front group and one just off the front group.
One just by, yeah. Yeah.
So four Intermarché teammates didn't stop. I suppose they did have a man interested in the sprint, didn't they? And I suppose Louis Menkes has got a decent overall position to defend.
Also, chaps, I don't want to encourage conspiracy theorists, but the fact that Ryan Taramay was wearing a red jersey sponsored by Carrefour, which is a very big supermarket chain, in France and Spain and Italy and other countries as well, and he rides for another extremely big supermarket chain in France, and Intermarché. I mean, they might be completely coincidental, the two things. I don't know.
I mean, it's an odd one, that, though, isn't it?
That's an extraordinary... Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, get yourself out of the race lead because you're advertising a different supermarket. I think that's a stretch too far, even for me. And I'm sitting here in a tinfoil hat, chaps. Anyway, just on Ryan Taramay, Will Fotheringham posted a very droll tweet last night. The rain in Spain falls mainly on the plane. Don't want to make light of his second crash in as many days today, but that was a good bit of wordplay. And other riders who were down, Mikel Nieve was down and had some nasty-looking wounds. And Romain Bardet, probably... the biggest name to hit the ground, and he has lost quite a lot of time. He came in the last group. I think they were over 12 minutes down, 12 and a half minutes down. So that left the sprint, and it was a second stage win of the race for Jasper Philipsen of Alpecin Fenix. Fabio Jakobsen was second. They are going head-to-head in these sprints, aren't they? But it's 2-1 now to Philipsen. Overall, Kenny Ellison takes the red jersey from Taramay because Taramay came in 2 minutes 21 down, and Ellison on the podium pulled on his extra small red jersey, and it still looked a little bit big for him. But he leads by 5 seconds ahead of Primoz Roglic and Lilian Calmejan in third place overall at the moment. Jasper Philipsen takes the green jersey back from Jakobsen, but there's only 1 point in it.
You are listening to Vueltas y Revueltas, the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
My name is Charlotte Hayes, and I am head of diabetes wellness and education at Team Novo Nordisk. I'm primarily here with the Talent AD camp. We have almost 30 young riders here who have been identified through our Talent ID pool. They've been invited here because they show promise and commitment to the sport. We're doing a lot of education with them. We did physiologic testing and lactate testing yesterday. We're meeting with them about their diabetes management on the bike to just kind of get a background with them, measuring A1C levels, and then looking at skills and fitness on the rides. So we did a 3-hour ride with a time trial this morning. They'll be riding 4 hours tomorrow, 5 hours the next day. So we're getting to know them. We're hoping that they're getting a lot of benefit from learning from us. If you go in that room, they're in a ping pong tournament right now, so they're getting to know each other. And one of the great things about Talent ID is that a lot of these kids have been racing and living as the N of one with type 1 diabetes in their communities, but now they have a whole team of, you know, fellow cyclists like them. So there's a great bonding that's going on too. Probably the best part.
Thanks very much indeed to our title sponsor, Super Sapiens. And we heard there from Charlotte Hayes, who's head of diabetes wellness and education at Team Novo Nordisk, the all diabetic cycling team. I spoke to her at the Talent ID camp that they held in Normandy a few weeks ago, and she was fascinating, speaking about how technology is helping diabetics to manage their diabetes, and how with Super Sapiens that technology is now can now be used by everybody. You can win 3 months supply of Super Sapiens to for continuous glucose monitoring to help you with your fueling. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to find out how to enter. We want a 60-second clip of audio, 60 seconds or less, telling us how and why you would use Super Sapiens. Daniel, it sounds very bustly where you are. Where are you?
Well, I'm in, as explained earlier, Richard, in...
But where precisely are you?
I'm in the Taperia Sugar, which is not a Spanish word. It would be azúcar in Spanish. Taperia Sugar in Albacete. Albacete, a town that doesn't have a particularly sparkling reputation, you know, as a tourist destination. I'm surrounded by Albacete natives, so I won't repeat. There's quite a famous Spanish idiom which refers to what you might like to do in Albacete and how little time you would like to spend there. But as I say, if I utter it now, I might have the local heavies on me.
Well, you might also have the local heavies on you for mistaking.
Oh God!
We had an email from Hector Herranz, yeah, who sounds Spanish. So, very nice email. Thanks, Hector, for your email. But just a small thing. Apparently, now you said abanichos. Is that right? Abanichos. You were talking about
abanichos. Yeah.
Abanicos, they mean echelons rather than crosswinds, according
yes,
to Hector.
Yes, well, yeah, that's true. That is true.
Abanicos. Well, we didn't see any abanicos today, apart from after the crash when, you know, there were groups kind of spread across the road. That was, I suppose, a little bit disappointing for those of us who like crosswinds. You don't, Daniel. I mean, they make you sad. So you'd be very happy tonight.
I was curious actually to ask Napalm Rich. He's been watching on TV throughout this week. Has it been a bit of a throwback, you know, across the sort of Dust Bowl of Castilla, La Mancha, a bit of a throwback to those welters of the late 90s and early 2000s, when on Eurosport you'd have David Duffield commentating in the UK and people like Inigo Charo and I can't remember, Fabio Roscioli would be in the break every day. It felt a bit like that to me today.
Yeah, it has been a bit like that, hasn't it? Long straight roads, and my dividing the welter up into different colours. It was certainly a brown stage today, wasn't it? I'm half expecting Angel Casero to suddenly win it in a final day time trial. Maybe he could roll back the years, the 2001 winner. It does feel a bit like a welter from 20 years ago, in a way.
Well, Daniel, you spoke at the start to the rider placed second overall and tantalizingly close to the red jersey, Kenny Ellison.
I teed him up like a Titleist Pro V1, didn't I? That will mean nothing to you, Richard.
No, I don't know what you're talking about. I assume it's a golf reference.
It is. But yes, I had a lovely audience with the King this morning in Tarancón. Okay, Kenny, 50. I've mentioned your weight before in interviews, 52 kilos. You might be the lightest guy in the peloton. On a day like today, how nervous are you?
It's okay. I mean, if I would do the GC, I would be afraid, maybe, but no, I am no stress. Anyway, the plan would be to lose time to be again able to go in a breakaway anyway, so... in 2 days, there is that little climb, and Roglic is 5 seconds behind me anyway, so the plan would be to lose time at one point to enjoy the hard stage we're coming after in Aron Alicante.
So you're not thinking about general classification, no? I mean, because you're still very, very close.
Yeah, I know, but the mistake would be to be between two chairs, you know, as we say in France, and trying to do a little bit of GC, and but at the end, you know, being stuck between the two position and finish an empty left hand, empty ended, you said? So I would, I think, prefer rather like lose time and try to go for a stage. I mean, I miss the win a lot, like since a long time.
I think the last win was Angliru, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It was 8 years ago.
So what do you make of that, chaps? Was well, we know that all joking aside, King Kenny was he wasn't thrilled to take the red jersey in the circumstances that he did take them with Ryan Taramai crashing today. But it's funny, isn't it, how you know you can completely rule something out and almost tempting fate in the
reverse curse,
yeah,
I think,
then he finds himself in the red jersey this afternoon.
And you know, we were talking a couple of days ago about how long Taramai could hold on to it, but Kenny Elissonde has, Roglic is very, very close, but you know, he's a good climber. He's not going to win the Vuelta, but he could have a few days in red jersey, could he not?
This throws up a really interesting scenario because Rog is within a time bonus of King Kenny's red jersey, and tomorrow's finish is a 2 kilometer quite steep uphill finish, and it is perfect for Rog. It's got Rog painted all over the road effectively.
Is it not also perfect for a breakaway though?
I was thinking about this earlier. Rog effectively, well, he made no bones about the fact that he didn't want to go for the stage win, or he sort of renounced the chance to go for the stage win at Picon Blanco. So that was, you know, we talk a lot, or I harp on about it all the time, Rog's penchant for claiming a time bonus, and how this has been key really to his Grand Tour win so far, his 2 Vuelta wins, and he's forsaken 10 seconds already at Picon Blanco. If he was to decide that he wanted to give King Kenny another day in red, and you know, another day with Jumbo-Visma not having to pull, could he engineer that tomorrow possibly I don't know really how he could contribute to the break staying away. But yeah, I mean, if two opportunities go past without him taking time bonuses, then that might be quite significant when we get to the end of the race.
What about the circumstances that he took the jersey then? Because I mean, it was very close to the finish, wasn't it? 11.7 kilometers to go, and everyone was starting to think about the sprint, and Taramai was left completely isolated for a little while, and then by the time he did join up with some teammates, the red jersey was completely gone. But the peloton didn't exactly push on, did they? They did, you know, they did kind of respect the unwritten rule of not putting their foot on the floor as soon as you know, they'd realised that the crash had happened behind them. There was a sort of a lull, a bit of a truce for a few kilometres, but it wasn't enough to allow Taramai to get back on. But you know, Elissonde, you know, couldn't do anything about that really. He couldn't sort of slow down and stop in solidarity. He just had to ride in safely and take what came, which is the red jersey, and the first time that he's led a Grand Tour in his career.
It was probably just too close to the finish, wasn't it, for there to be a wait? Because normally when the race leader goes down, the bunch would wait or soft pedal for a bit. Had it been 20 kilometres out, that might have happened, but 11 kilometres was just a little bit too close to the finish, and the sprint teams were all getting organised at that point, weren't they? So very unlucky for Taramai, but I guess people will be flocking back to Intermarché tomorrow, having been shopping in Carrefour for the last couple of days. And he seemed pretty sanguine about it. I mean, he gets the King of the Mountains jersey as consolation, doesn't he?
Yeah, and he said that 2 days in the red jersey was enough for him. He'd enjoyed those 2 days. But back to King Kenny, chaps, and the sort of irony or the incongruity of... Is it incongruity a word? Was it incongruousness?
Yes. Yeah. It's a good word.
The incongruity of King Kenny, the 52-kilo King Kenny taking the...
It means crosswinds in Spanish.
Yeah, taking the red jersey on the day when, well, which would be most favourable to a big hefty rouleur. I, as well as talking to him this morning about, or him talking to me about how he would probably lose time almost deliberately over the next few days, I did also talk to him a little bit about his general craft in crosswinds and what he learned over the years as such a small rider, and a rider who, let's not forget, started his career in this kind of golden French generation of Thibaut Pinot and Romain Bardet, being hotly tipped as a GC hope. And that hasn't quite materialised. I mean, he's with his stature, it's very difficult for him, you know, to rival the best riders in time trials. But we did talk about crosswinds this morning. Crosswinds that didn't materialise, but he was certainly ready and waiting when the stress was turned on and the crash happened in the finale today.
And Kenny, just on crosswinds, if you compare your approach now to when you started your career as a pro, what are the big lessons that you've learned about how to avoid splits in crosswinds over the years? What are the most important things you've learned?
I mean, it's a team effort, obviously, and you need to actually be in position like 20k before the corners, the crosswind happens, because then all the team blocks the road. And if you're not, you cannot pass anymore. It's not like you can, even with a, like let's say for example today, like there is headwind before, and you can say, oh, I'm gonna sit at the back and go at the last minute because it's big road and the crosswind, so I can do a jump at the last minute before the left corner. But no, already like before the corner with a headwind, all the team will be positioned like this. I can block the road until the left corner with a headwind. So you need to be prepared like maybe 40k before the crosswind section happens. So this is why you see often the bunch a bit stressed and like all on the same road a long time before. So the peloton is riding more defensive. You can see even yesterday, like there were like no much chance of crosswind, but it was pretty nervous all day actually. So yeah. Well, this is the kind of sentiment I have learned in the years. You need to be in a good position more and more before it happens, actually.
Will there be a lot of talk in the radio at that moment, or is all the work done before the stage?
Before the stage, we already know the important point. We already know where you need to be in position. What can change is we have some scoot in front of the race. Like, let's say one guy from the team, and he will have this instrument, you know, this tool with the wind, and he'll say if the wind pick up during the day or it being less. But at the end of the day, even if they say less, everybody will be positioned like the same because everybody is so stressful, you know, and the DS also, they put no pressure, but you know, they say you need to be in position because even if there is no real risk, but actually they say nothing and we are behind, then they have trouble also. So this is why every DS say you need to be in front, you need to be in front, and everybody wants to be in front.
You better go or else you'll already be dropped before the start. Yeah. Thanks, Kenny.
Well, King Kenny there, chaps, very popular wearer of the red jersey, as we heard his teammate Kiel Reinen suggest at the start of the episode. I mentioned, you know, when he turned pro 2011, well, he was a trainee with FDJ 2011. He'd won the Ronde de l'Isard that year, big stage race in the Pyrenees, which has always sort of earmarked some of the top talents coming through into the pro ranks. I think he could have turned pro with Patrick Lefebvre's team at the time, Quickstep, but he didn't want to. He didn't think that was going to be right for him. He didn't think he was mature enough. I learned today, chaps, as well, there's a curious little Spanish connection or reference. He was born on the 22nd of July 1991, and there was some home video, I don't know whether how soon after the birth, but apparently you can hear, or King Kenny has said previously that you can hear the commentary from the Tour de France in the background, and Miguel Indurain being congratulated on taking or on holding the yellow jersey. I think it was a stage from Gap to Alès, or vice versa, Alès to Gap, in fact. And yeah, Indurain was in the yellow jersey. And yeah, King Kenny came into the world precisely at that moment. 25 years ago, of course, Indurain was riding his last Vuelta a España, and sort of pulling to the side of the road just before the Lagos de Covadonga and retiring effectively.
That Ronda Lizard race 10 years ago, that was, Elizonde won it. I'm just looking up, George Bennett was second and Joe Dombrowski was third. And there's another couple of former winners of that race also riding this Vuelta, Andrea Baggioli and Pavel Sivakov, our audio diarist. So, yeah, a marker for future success.
Well, shall we hear from El Civ now? Because when we thought the crosswinds were going to materialise at 31 kilometres to go, he was the keenest for it, it looked. I mean, they obviously, you could see the GC teams massing at the front, and it was Civ that really took it on, didn't he? And really, really kind of went for it until a tap on his rear from Egan Bernal sort of stopped the effort. You spoke to him at the finish, Daniel.
Well, Pavel, everyone knew that it was, well, there could be crosswinds at 31k to go. You led into that bend, and then we saw Egan put his hand on your back. And was that to say, look, the wind's not strong enough?
Yeah, it wasn't really a great place. I think it was a bit better closer to the finish. But yeah, we just wanted to be safe. I mean, if we can be in the front, just avoid any crash. You know, there is always a probability to crash in one of those bends. So I know we did like this. Actually, in the radio, I thought they were telling me to go. That's why I accelerated even harder. But it was actually the opposite. So the wind wasn't strong, but at the end you also have to stay in front because we saw what happened closer to the finish, just to crash, and then the peloton split in two.
And it looked like there were a couple of teams who were still trying to split. Cerny of the Koenig Quickstep, Groupama a couple of times. Again, was the direction right for the race to split, or was that wrong as well?
I think we would need it a bit more. Tail cross was more a head cross. Yeah, I think Astana went pretty hard at one point with Izagirre and Vlasov, but Cerny closed the gap, and I think that the wind wasn't strong enough. I think now it was more like the tension and a crash that could cause some splits, so everyone wanted to be in front.
And a big relief to get that day out of the way with, I think, all of your leaders came through safely.
Yeah, exactly. Big relief to that's one of those days you just want to get through. Everyone got through safe. Richard was actually involved in the crash. I mean, he didn't crash, but he was behind him. And then I had to close the gap with him. But yeah, we did it, so no problems. I think I was good.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks very much indeed to Science in Sport, our longtime sponsor. If you would like to stock up on Science in Sport sports nutrition products, go to scienceandsport.com and at the checkout, use the code SISCP25 for 25% off. SISCP25. Before the break there, we heard from El Civ, didn't we? And I guess the crosswinds that we were expecting but didn't materialize was one of the stories of the day. We were hoping for that. Even Daniel, I'm sure, secretly was hoping for that. And all the, as I mentioned earlier, all the GC teams were certainly prepared for it. But it just wasn't blowing quite strongly enough, and as Civ said, Sivakov, that is, it wasn't blowing in the right direction as well, which was key.
No, that's right, Rich, and there were a few teams who, well, sort of stubbornly refused to accept that the bunch wasn't going to split. De Koenig Quickstep, as they always are, they were really keen to split it. Joseph Cerny tried a few times, and as El Civ mentioned there, Astana also had a go at one point. But yeah, a little bit from the point of view of Fernando Escartín, certainly, who I mentioned at the start of the pod tonight, who had designed this course, designed this stage specifically because he wanted the race to be split apart. A little bit disappointing, I suppose. There's another stage, well, even tomorrow there could be some wind, and then there's another stage to La Manga in a couple of days where we could have wind again. But I think the general classification riders will be very relieved, won't they? But it was interesting to hear there from Sivakov that he had actually had to pace Carapaz back after the crash today. And, you know, this underlines again the perils of this multi-leader strategy that Ineos have. They came through unscathed today, but the domestiques have always got to be aware of what three guys are doing and where three guys are, haven't they? Bernal, Carapaz, although Carapaz has already lost time, and Yates. Yates, I thought today, looked very good. He was right at the front where he needed to be at all times.
Yeah, it's a gamble, though, putting on a stage like this, knowing that if the wind doesn't blow, it's likely to be extremely uneventful. But it wasn't, because obviously there was a crash. It was kind of the wrong sort of drama again. I'd much rather, I know Daniel, crosswinds make you sad, but I think crashes make me sadder, because it's an actual negative kind of impact on the race, whereas crosswinds do reward, you know, risk taking and organization and planning and strategy. But yeah, the wind wasn't strong enough. I mean, I was looking at the BBC's weather forecast, and of course was looking for Albacete, and it was saying sort of 4 or 5 miles an hour, which is not likely to be enough to split it. But of course, out in the plains, out in the countryside, where there's not a lot getting in the way of the wind, if it's blowing, it could have been a very different picture. But in terms of the impact it has on the race that perhaps, you know, we don't appreciate quite so much, it's that all of that nervousness, the jostling for position, the stress, everybody anticipating that the wind might blow, that this change of direction is at a certain point, 31 kilometres from the finish. And possibly, you know, that contributed to the crash, because everybody's on their nerves for, 20 kilometres before the change of direction. Then maybe there's a little bit of a relaxation, and then there's another kind of wave of stress going through the peloton as the race for the sort of 3K to go marker comes. So, you know, although it didn't look action-packed, it still has an impact on the race. And as always, there are winners and losers. Tara May obviously losing the red jersey, but Romain Bardet of DSM, basically, 12 and a half minutes, his overall chances completely gone, but perhaps even his participation in the race will be in doubt, depending on how he comes through this evening and what the extent of his injuries are.
It continued that trend as well of these enormous pile-ups. We've seen a lot of these recently. Just a rider goes down and takes down, you know, two-thirds of the bunch, it looks like. And I wonder if that's because they're bunched so close together, again, because of the threat of wind. You know, in those, if there's a threat of crosswinds, you tend to, there's nervousness, but there's also just riding, you're more tightly packed together. And, you know, we saw yesterday, Taramai went down close to the finish when the bunch was going really fast, and he only went down on his own, didn't take anybody with him. Today was just absolutely catastrophic in terms of the number of riders it affected and took down. And what's amazing is that Bardet was really the only GC rider who seemed to be badly hurt in it.
Well, we heard chats, didn't we? King Kenny really spell it out in that interview with me this morning, how it's not just, you know, a kilometre or 5 kilometres even before the crucial moment that people are on the radio or they know they have to be in position. It can be, well, he said 40 kilometres before the crucial point. And it's the same really for every team. You know, some teams are maybe more meticulous, more forensic than others, but pretty much everyone has the same resources. And we keep saying it, don't we, that this is definitely contributing to crashes and nervousness in the peloton. But it's very difficult to know or think of a way that cycling can wind back from that. You know, a lot of these devices and apps and various things, instruments that are used, they help in various respects. They help people to stay safe, but it's just when everyone is trying to fight for the same few centimetres of road, then crashes are going to be inevitable.
I was just going to say, Richard, yeah, that this trend is certainly in this race. You know, the crashes are happening right in the middle, very close to the front. And of course, the message that all the riders are getting is, if you get to the front, you'll be safer because there's fewer people in front of you, fewer variables, fewer unpredictable moves, perhaps. But certainly the last couple of days, the crashes have been happening in that sweet spot, the place where the riders would think perhaps they would be safer, the place where they're all trying to get to. I mean, it's at what point do they think that perhaps it's a little bit safer to hang back? But as you say, Rich, that with crosswinds, even just leaving half a bike length can be the difference between making a group and not making a group. So no real chance to take any, take chances, really.
One team that got lots of numbers through unscathed was Alpecin Fenix. We should really talk about the second stage win for Jasper Philipsen, shouldn't we? I was sure Arnaud Démare was going to do it. They also had lots of numbers at the finish. But Alpecin Fenix really doing a De Koenig quick step, really impressive as a team. We keep saying it, but a one-man team, we thought, at the start of the year. And they're proving to be one of the most successful, one of the most prolific teams in Grand Tours this year.
Yeah, and they corrected the mistake they made yesterday, didn't they? There was some conjecture over whether Sacha Modelor had deliberately, taken a flyer as they came to the finish yesterday and Philipsen had let him go. If you looked at the footage more closely, I don't think that was the case. I think Modelor had simply got the timing wrong. But Philipsen, this evening, when he talked about the stage win in his press conference, he was particularly pleased and effusive about the fact that the whole team had been there and contributing at the front at the end. And contrast that with Groupama FDJ, who have really not got their timings right yet, have they? Or haven't found their best legs, certainly not on a consistent basis in the Vuelta, and they sort of fell apart again a little bit.
Yeah, they had the numbers, but not the organisation, really. And you wonder, again, I think the confidence and form of the main man, the sprinter, has a huge effect on the rest of the team, doesn't it? I mean, they were such a well-oiled machine at the Giro last year. A lot of the same riders. But when Démare isn't quite firing, it doesn't it's not quite as well-oiled. There's a bit of sand, a bit of grit in there. No, very impressive by Philipsen indeed. Fabio Jakobsen up there again in second. What can you tell us, though, about the young sprinter, Italian sprinter, Alberto Dainese, on Team DSM? He's 23 years old and he's been up there in a few of the sprints.
Yeah, Rich, he's quite a small, stocky sort of sprinter from Padova, which is synonymous as well in Italian cycling with another very good sprinter from the 1990s, Silvio Martinello, who was very successful on the track for many years. And Padova has quite a rich tradition of producing particularly good riders on the flat and on the track. Andrea Leoni was another one in the 90s, another very good sprinter from that neck of the woods. So, yeah, he's very promising. And, that was a bright note for them, wasn't it, today, on a day when Romain Bardet crashed that he was going to be out of the race. But he got up and, the team were quite hopeful this evening about Bardet's chances of continuing the Vuelta. And I spoke to Matt Winston, their direct sportif, at the finish, and he said precisely that he was pretty optimistic about Romain Bardet's chances of continuing in this race, at the time of recording at least.
Yeah, he actually avoided the original crash and kind of just got through on the right-hand side, and then he was just hit from behind, which then took him down into the side of the road. Lucky that once again we have Dyneema in the kit, which has saved a lot of the injuries. We'll obviously assess him now after the race, but he was able to come across the finish line in a good way. Yeah, I mean he was in pain on the way into the line. So our doctors will assess him kind of this evening and we'll make a judgment there. But he was safe to continue to get to the finish, and that was the main thing for us. We checked him properly after the crash, made sure he wasn't concussed or anything like that, and then came to the finish with him in a good and safe way. But we'll keep assessing him through the evening.
Well, Dainese is definitely going in the right direction. Fourth yesterday, third today. If that trend continues, two more sprint finishes and he'll be the winner. And DSM certainly need a win. They're one of the few teams, one of the few World Tour teams still waiting for a Grand Tour stage victory this season. But just on the sprint, it was a slightly unusual one, wasn't it? Because I think the speed was knocked off so much after the crash, it was sort of another 5k really before they got going again. So it was a sort of a different and slightly truncated lead out for the finish. But just a word for Jakobsen, who obviously won yesterday, found himself in not the ideal position and still managed to find his way through. It was an impressive move by Jakobsen, and it's brewing into quite a battle between these two, Philipsen and Jakobsen, and it's you know, with quite so many potential sprint finishes still to come, it's good to see that we've got this well-matched contest between the two of them. And of course, they're not just going for stage wins, but the race for the green jersey is up for grabs as well. As I said, just one point in it, with Philipsen taking the green jersey back from Jakobsen today. And with the number of points on offer at the intermediate sprints, it does mean that these stages have got a bit more going for them than just, you know, basically waiting for the windsock to pick up or bracing yourself for crashes.
Well, what are we expecting tomorrow, chaps? Is a nasty kicker at the end. At least there is, according to the road book. I'm sure you've dug a little bit deeper, Daniel. What do we expect tomorrow?
Do you want an omen, chaps? A little pointer to who might do well tomorrow. So the finish tomorrow, officially, it's...
Yeah, that just passed him by, didn't it? He didn't hear that,
sorry,
did he?
I didn't hear you, go on.
A Sam Omen.
Oh, a Sam Omen, very good. Extremely good. You're still on top of your game, Rich. In spite of not being here. The finish tomorrow is in Cullera, which is in the Valencian community. And it's actually, its real name, the climb where we finish tomorrow, a little climb, 2 kilometer climb, is the Munt de l'Or, or the Montaña de l'Or, the Golden Mountain. Who could possibly win there? Who has come to the Vuelta a España?
Well, three. There are three possibilities.
Rather exaggeratedly bedecked in gold.
Richard Carapaz or Primoz Roglic or Tom Pidcock, who doesn't seem to be sporting any gold
there
at all, does he?
Pidcock actually could be a good bet.
We were wondering the other day, just briefly on Pidcock, what he's doing at the Vuelta. I mean,
shall I find out? Is this a mission that you're giving me to find out tomorrow morning?
I wonder, we were expecting great things from him, and he does seem to be... I mean, as much as you can, riding within yourself. I spotted him today chatting for a long time to Jack Haig at the back of the bunch. Not a care in the world. But I wonder if he's training, if he's using it partly as to gain experience, obviously, his first Grand Tour, but also with the Worlds in mind, because it's a very similar course to Brabantse Pijl, where he was second, of course, to Wout van Aert earlier in the year.
I've got another theory. He's here. Mm-hmm. He's here specifically for tomorrow's stage. The very famous Medusa Dance Music Festival that is traditionally held in mid-August, and in fact was last week. And he's just a week late.
Oh, right.
Have you
well,
ever
that's
heard
another
of,
interesting
I'd never
theory.
Heard of, I'd never heard of this because no. I'm not really into dance music, but this is apparently a big thing in Cullera. Either of you?
Wow.
Lionel?
I'm
in
sure
your
Lionel's
Ministry
been.
Of Sound days?
No, Benicassim, a big festival at Benicassim,
yes,
lots of dance
I've heard
music
of that.
There. That's, but I mean, that's a different one.
While you're there and we're not, Daniel, we can basically just assign missions to you. We can give you jobs to do. So please, tomorrow, find out what Tom Pidcock's plans here at the Vuelta are.
If I can impart just the last couple of pieces of useless trivia, this mountain, this hill above Cullera, is apparently the last mountain. I mean, it's not really a mountain, it's 233 meters high. The last mountain or the last elevation of the Iberian system before the Mediterranean Sea. Do you know what? I was kicking myself slightly, Rich, because last night I went down a bit of a rabbit hole reading about Molina de Aragon, where we were yesterday, which apparently... it has become infamous as what people call a population desert. It's one of the least populated places in Europe, got lower population density than Lapland and Siberia. And it's also known as the Spanish Siberia because it's also consistently one of the coldest places in Spain.
Wow. Well. It did feel, as I said in last night's podcast, desert-like. Very, very barren and... you went through little villages and towns and lots of people out watching the race, but nothing for miles and miles around. Fascinating. What are your plans now then, Daniel? Where are you headed tonight?
We are heading, well, I'm heading about halfway. I think I've got about an hour's journey to the hotel tonight. I heard tonight that the team, a lot of the teams, I don't know if it's all of them, because hotels are pretty scarce around here, maybe for the reasons I explained earlier about Albacete, it's not exactly a well-known tourist destination. A lot of the teams are staying in Valencia, and Valencia is right on the coast. And if they are staying in Valencia, they'll have to come another, I don't know, hour or more, a couple of hours inland to the start tomorrow. And then they'll end up tomorrow after the stage at very close to Valencia again. So I think that the general consensus so far in the Vuelta is that the transfers have been pretty grueling and pretty long. And that's not going to stop this evening, certainly as far as the teams are concerned.
Well, we wish you luck on your transfer. Just a little reminder that our latest episode of Kilometer Zero was released today. The Other Slovenians doesn't really need much more explanation than that. It's an interview with some of the Slovenians who are in the race. Well, the three Slovenians who are in the race. Another couple of people on the race who are Slovenian as well. And it does actually include a little word from Primož Roglič at the start, who, with Tadej Pogačar, is one of the two superstars from that country, of course. So it's a little dive into what's going on in Slovenia from the perspective of some of the guys who we don't hear from as much as we do from Roglic and Pogacar. And the third episode in our Kilometer Zero series will come out on Friday.
It's in the works.
So listen out for that. Yes, looking forward to that one. Well, safe travels, Daniel, and hope you find a nice place for dinner and maybe a glass of the local wine.
Maybe a Bobal tonight.
Bobal. You're making me... I'm really feeling like I'm missing out now. Don't know about... Crosswinds don't make me sad, but missing out on nice dinners in Spain with beautiful wine, that makes me
gonna
sad.
You're going to say with tremendous company there, but no.
And that, yeah, as well, yeah. Of course. Yeah. Well, good luck to you, and we'll speak to you again tomorrow.
Chaps. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lionel.
Cheers.